This episode of the Squawker Talker is brought to you by Beer 52. Beer 52 is the world's number one craft beer club and delivers crates of hand-picked craft beer to your door. Squawker Talker listeners can get £12 off a crate and two free beers by using the code SQUAWKER at checkout. So if you like a good deal on beer, visit beer52.com. Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. And joining me this week is City AM sports correspondent, Joe Hall. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm great. I'm pretty good. Thanks.
Yeah, making your debut on the podcast today.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I used to be one of the Squawker family a long time back, so it's good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back. And I guess the first thing we've got to talk about, it's been a momentous week for English football, in one way at least, and that's Leicester City making all the way through to the last eight of the Champions League. No one expected it. I mean, on this podcast, even the articles we've written on the site, when they got drawn with Sevilla for the round of 16, I think everyone wrote them off, really. Sampaoli, this guy who was going to take over Barcelona at one point, this amazing side that he plays, very frantic, intense football. They were going to rip this team who were set for relegation apart, but that's not what happened, is it, Joe?
No, it couldn't be further from what happened, really. I mean, as someone who doesn't watch Sevilla every week, you know, I kind of took some of the Spanish football experts' words as gospel. I was really excited to see the Sevilla team, and we saw it for about an hour in the first leg. This team that almost looked like they could be a real force in the competition, and then it was kind of something switched when that Jamie Vardy goal went in, and then on Tuesday night it was just like the old Leicester again. And Sevilla were disappointing. Leicester were immense, probably their best performance of the season so far.
But what would you say is the thing that's changed about Leicester?
I think this Leicester team is nothing revolutionary. We've seen this Leicester before. It's almost really the same team, that kind of classic team that won the league last year that we're all going to remember.
It's like the magic's back, isn't it?
Yeah, really? And the magic is back. I mean, that magic or that kind of soul does manifest itself really in the winning second balls, that kind of ferocity that they play with, the getting it forward at rapid speed, Jamie Vardy being niggly, probably even something like winding up Sam Nasri, having the gall and the urge and the winning mentality to do it. It was all there, and we haven't seen it. And it sounds, sometimes these things are hard to quantify, the winning second ball, but you could see Sevilla were shell-shocked a little bit. It was even in the crowd. The crowd seemed as up for it, just like they did last season. It was, and Sevilla didn't really know how to cope. They almost tried to, Sevilla came there almost saying, okay, we'll play them at their own game. And Leicester are masters at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost reminded me of, you say the second ball is hard to quantify, but I mean, that's something that Guardiola's discussed this season with his struggles with Man City. So maybe there is an element that's maybe an edge that Leicester are using against the European sides, maybe.
And I think it was an edge for Leicester last season against top teams. It was an edge for them when they battered City early in the season at the King Power. And I think it's, European, especially the European elite, they're not used to playing against sides that put so much stock in that way of playing. And I think it probably, it probably does rock you if you spend every week after week, practicing how to beat a press and stuff like that. And you're not really as concerned with, the knockdown off a free kick. It will probably take you by surprise a little bit when these teams kind of come knowing how to win those duels.
I know it's almost becoming cliche to say, oh, Leicester are doing to the Champions League what they did with the Premier League. But you look at the stats, they're 29th out of 32 for average possession in Champions League games. They've only got 42% average possession. So it literally looks like they are just giving the other team the ball and then going, we're just going to run at you.
Is that right? 32. So even in the group stages, they were...
Yeah, out of the 32 teams that made it into the group stages, Leicester are 29th for average possession in games.
There you go. I think I would say one thing for Leicester. I mean, it's a beautiful story. It's so romantic. I felt good watching it again until, apart from some of the maybe slightly ugly stuff regarding Nasri. But, it was a feel-good Leicester story again. They haven't really. Sevilla was probably one of the better draws I thought that they could have got early on, and in the last 16, their group was easy. And when they came up against the best team in that group, they struggled at Porto. So they've had a kind draw, and they've had a nice introduction into it. And I, you know, looking ahead, I think they might struggle in the quarters.
Well, I mean, they've been drawn, if people are listening and haven't seen the draw, they've been drawn with Atletico Madrid.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, okay, this might be a bit of a reductive thing to say, but like a better version of what Leicester could become, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. It is slightly reductive, but in simplistic terms, that's kind of what they are. Mm. You know, there was that the banner before the Leicester game, the tifo that the fans had, it said, what was it? It was the Julius Caesar quote, something about let loose the dogs of war.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So if Leicester are dogs of war, Atletico are the rabid wolves.
Yeah, yeah.
War. So do you know what I mean? They kind of are a more sophisticated version at doing. Mm. You know, they do a lot of that stuff that Leicester do very well. But they also kind of have a bit of culture about them and just quality as well.
You've got Yannick Carrasco, the Belgian Mark Albrighton. You've got Koke, yeah. The Spanish Danny Drinkwater.
Yeah, I think both of those guys. Not sure that's how they describe themselves.
Is Griezmann the French Vardy? Is that?
Yeah, I think he's got a better celebration for sure. Slightly cooler. But yeah, I think it's going to be really tough ask for Leicester. And I almost think, you know, what we were talking about with Leicester doing to the Champions League, what they did to the Premier League. You know, I think even some of the elite teams, there would be a level of intrigue there with the likes of Bayern, Real Madrid, Barcelona. You know, how could Leicester really, you know, step it up a notch and do the same thing to them? There's not quite the same dynamic with Atletico Madrid. So yeah, it'll be really tough. But I mean, I've tried to be a cynical guy so many times over the last 18 months and put you know, pour water on the dream. So I'm not going to do that again. It could happen.
It's kind of hard having seen what happened last year when everyone said, "Oh, it's not going to happen." I'm okay. They've drawn Atletico, probably the most awkward draw out of all the teams could have got. Because you know, getting someone a bit more glamour. No disrespect for Atletico.
And they're like a Champions League. Another thing people forget. I still feel sometimes don't talk about Atletico Madrid. They're one of the best performing teams in the Champions League over the last 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they haven't won it, but they've probably been the second best team consistently. You know, they've topped Bayern in the group.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just feel like people, you know, people don't talk about them even as the favourites now.
Absolutely. But and what I meant is that they're natural underdogs in a way that Leicester kind of are. So they haven't even got the whole kind of David Goliath thing they can properly go for.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got drew with Barcelona and Real Madrid. Okay, they've got the quality, but you've got the narrative there to kind of help. Exactly. Kind of undercut that by taking
you know, exactly. I don't think, you know, for example, Leicester fans, if it was Bayern Munich or Barcelona, they would, you know, in 50 years' time say, hey, and grandson Isaac, let me tell you about the time I saw Robert Lewandowski come to the King Power.
Exactly.
They're not going to do that about the Belgian Mark Albrighton, as good as he is.
Or even Kevin Gamero, no offence to him either, but...
Yeah, exactly. They just don't have that, like, sprinkle of stardust as the other teams. You're right, mm-hmm. for sure.
Next up for Leicester in the league are West Ham this weekend. I mean, we're talking about their transformation. It all seems to have stemmed from the sacking of Ranieri. And remember when that happened, it was a crime against football. I think I even tweeted the timing of this sacking is bizarre. And then they went and did that to Sevilla. So what do I know? But it's kind of becoming a bit like what happened with Nigel Atkins at Southampton, isn't it? As in everyone thought that was another crime against football and then realised, wait, Mauricio Pochettino is a really good manager. And this is one of the canniest decisions made in recent years. Do you think, okay, Craig Shakespeare hasn't got the record of making Espanyol into a fighting mid-table team in La Liga?
Next Arsenal manager, maybe.
Well, yeah, sure that hype will build. Yeah. But do you think that, is he more of a Di Matteo type figure maybe in this season?
Yeah, I think more than a posh. I don't think he's going to bring a whole new way of playing football into the Premier League like Pochettino did. But Di Matteo, I think, is a great example. I'm with you. I'm a sentimental football watcher. I you know, I think that stuff is important. I think that's why people like football. And you know, every neutral, every kind of casual fan I know who didn't pay attention to football every day was kind of put off by that story. It's hard to argue against it though now. And I think what you said about Di Matteo. Di Matteo came in, he kind of rallied around the big figures in the dressing room. AVB was bringing all these new ideas at Chelsea and they were struggling to adapt to it. You know, and Ranieri was trying new things this season.
Kind of went back to being the tinker man.
And you know, some of that I think was he felt he kind of had to because they had all these new demands. You know, Leicester hardly played a cup game last season, and he probably thought I'm not going to be able to play the same 11 week in week out. But for whatever reason, you know, it wasn't handled well, and I think with the secret of Leicester, if it is kind of putting in that extra yard of energy into the 93rd minute to close down that guy on the halfway line. You know, if you feel passionate and part of a project and you believe in it, And you know, I think one of the words you see the guys saying constantly is trust. And it's simple, and you know, it's easy to rally behind again. So I think it has paid off. I think it will see them through to the rest of the season, and I think they'll beat West Ham.
On that note, though, we've got a question through from Greg Evans on Twitter. He says, where do you think Leicester would be in the Premier League if their current form had been present since the start of the season?
Well, they won 3 out of 3 with Shakespeare, so...
Power race.
Yeah. I think for a lot of the season, you know, people forget they haven't been in the relegation zone. And it was only really, I think, after Christmas when things really started to go sour. I think a lot of stats guys will be able to talk about this in more detail than me, but there is a sense of Leicester, you know, if you take their whole time in the Premier League and you add up all their results from the bad period to when they won the Premier League, they'd kind of be a lower mid-table team.
Yeah,
and that's kind of, if you look at the quality of their players, if you look at their performances, the amount of dominance they have against other teams, that's kind of where they should be. I think they were clearly, for the last few games under Ranieri, they were A, a bit unlucky, but B, kind of performing within themselves. So I think if they'd had the luxury of being able to play in the same way as last season, they would definitely have never really had a relegation shadow over them. But they were never going to be able to sustain last season stuff, because they did, you know, they rode the wave. They I don't want to use the word luck. It's not. It seems like I'm putting it down, but.
Wow. To go with a cliche, you make your own luck.
A lot of guys were saying, they got a lot of results that on another day could have easily swung the other way that season. This season, kind of, they got unlucky in some games.
You guys like Slimani have come in and he has made an impact. And you obviously got Ndidi, who's actually pretty good now. Maybe the future could be bright again for Leicester. I personally thought they were never going to defend their title.
Yeah.
I mean, top four was also a wild idea. Yeah. But, I think they've got the quality to be challenging Everton as that best of the rest spot.
They do have. I mean, they could still finish in the top half quite easily this season. And that is, you know, a pretty good performance. It was just a bad run after Christmas that Ranieri is on. And you mentioned Ndidi. I think he's perhaps taken a while to go into stride, but I thought he's great on the other night.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a very different player to Kante, but he's filling that void as almost like their X-factor player in that middle space. But we're going to move on now. We've talked a lot about Leicester. We're going to look at the other ties in the Champions League. I'd probably say two glamour fixtures, really. Juventus versus Barca and Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid. Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, both top of the table for chances created in the Champions League this season. I think Bayern are top, Real Madrid second. So, I mean, you look at the glamour and the amount of talent in those teams. Which one out of the two would you say is the one you want to watch the most?
Probably Real Madrid. They, you know, because they've been so good in La Liga this season. I want to see more of them. I want to kind of, still not quite sure what it is that Zidane does, you know, that makes him so good, but they are.
But you kind of got the apprentice versus the master thing of Ancelotti and Zidane.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's so many kind of former like levels of, there's a few different narratives you can spin out of
Tony
that one.
Tony Cruz as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Xabi Alonso. All of these guys, and there's probably more that not coming top of my head, but yeah, I think it will be really interesting. I think Ancelotti as well, who will be kind of, I think there'll be a lot of eyes on him in this season, the Champions League, because he's always kind of, I thought, been more a better tournament manager,
100%,
than a league. And we've seen Bayern not being at their imperious best in the league.
Although apparently they've actually got more. I think it's Christian Niari on Twitter says something like I think the gap's wider this time of the season it was last year.
Really?
So, yeah.
Well, there you go.
It's, maybe perspective is a play there.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe the fact that they took a while to pull away from a recently promoted team may change that perspective. But you know, and also I'm sure it lingered in the psyche of Bayern when Ancelotti turned up there a couple of years ago with Real Madrid and swept them away. Was it 4-0? So it'll be, you know, can he do the same back to his old side? Will be really interesting to watch. So I kind of started saying I really want to watch Real Madrid, and then I ended up saying it was actually, I'm more intrigued with Bayern. So I guess my mind's still to be made up there.
In terms of intrigue, I'm wondering whether, even though the amount of goals that Barcelona and PSG scored in their tie, I kind of look at Allegri, I look at Enrique, I look at the players there, and I kind of think Juventus-Barca might be a bit of a tactics fest.
Yeah, you know what? That one didn't, I didn't like see that one get drawn and be like, oh, scream. It didn't scream goals to me. It didn't scream entertainment. Yeah, I'm that's probably out of the four, the one that gets me least excited.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. what about Dortmund versus Monaco then? That's the fourth tie. We've obviously got Atletico Madrid versus Leicester City in the third one. But Dortmund versus Monaco, I mean, we're not going to use a whole hipster tag, but I mean, Monaco, only Barcelona have scored more goals in all competitions this season in the top five than Monaco. I think Barcelona got 129. Barcelona got 129. Monaco got 100. I can't remember what it was after last night, but it's a lot.
Great knowledge. Way. I mean, they are above 100, I'm pretty sure.
Way above. Yeah. And Dortmund obviously got loads of really great young players in there as well.
By the way, I don't know if you want to say, I meant that when you like reeled off Barcelona's goals in all competitions, I was great knowledge. I wasn't trying to be, I was impressed with that. I know exactly. You don't want to say, it sounds like the kind of thing that you'd say to sound smart. Dortmund, Monaco, but that is the one I want to watch.
Yeah, and you saw in the group stages, Dortmund versus Legia Warsaw. That was back and forth, They do let you play.
Dortmund are the second highest scorers in Bundesliga after Bayern. They score loads of goals too. But I think as well, I'm really glad that this draw happened because it means we're going to have a fairly unfamiliar team in the semi-finals. You know, we all know that one of Bayern, Real, Barcelona, or Atletico are going to be there. But the fact there's going to be, you know, I know Dortmund have been there, but they are more of a gatecrasher. Monaco would be a real, really interesting one. They've both actually kind of got a similar model now of being one of the top clubs in their leagues, but not quite the elite like PSG and Bayern are. They're not one of those just powerhouses that can just buy whoever they want. They're both quite smart now, and they've invested in young guys who they can then spin off to one of these elite clubs. But yeah, I mean, you look at Monaco's team of Mbappe. Okay, he's still pretty young. I wonder if they will be able to hold on to him. But
there's so many links. By the week, there are more clubs linked with him.
Yeah, I think guys like Fabinho and Mendy and
Bakayoko as well.
Yeah,
it's almost like every single position on their team, there's someone that someone wants to sign. Bernardo Silva's another one. Yeah.
In fact, at least a few of those guys are going to go, and the chances of them being able to rebuild and be in this position next season. Are quite slim, I guess. So,
if they've got this system all set up, you've kind of got to back them to find the next.
I always feel these always kind of take a couple of seasons to click together. But hey, you know, you're right. They've done well so far. So,
well, fingers crossed. We'd love to see a strong Monaco if they keep this up.
Yeah,
definitely. But you were talking about gate crashes there. I mean, I guess the obvious gate crasher is Leicester City. But why do you think it is that they're the only English representative in the quarterfinals this year?
Well, what I said earlier about them playing the easiest teams, I mean, that is just true. If they'd been drawn against Bayern, they wouldn't be there, I don't think. They're much less likely to be. So, but that's being a bit churlish. I think I kind of think we overthink this stuff about the English teams, and I don't think there's one thing you can put it down to. I think English teams have underperformed, but if you look at they've underperformed. Kind of a lot of them have had seasons of underperformance in the Premier League too.
Yeah,
we haven't had, I don't think, for the last 5-6 years, one team that's always been first or second. We haven't had Ferguson's United or Mourinho's mid-2000s Chelsea, which lasted after he went.
They had a real dynasty to them, didn't they?
Exactly, Wenger's in the late 90s, early 2000s. We haven't had a team like that. You know, we've had City winning the league and then just failing to defend the title. We've had Chelsea doing that. United struggling after Ferguson. So for these teams that just literally haven't built these dynasties, of course it's always going to be hard for them. Or it's always going to be unlikely for them to suddenly go and beat the best European sides who have. You know, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Real Madrid, they might not have had the long-serving managers, but they've had very consistent squads. They've been dominating their leagues. They've kind of built themselves up into this elite, almost untouchable level that the Premier League clubs just haven't been at, even the best ones.
Well, that's kind of what I think, in that maybe this is going to sound horrendously anti-Premier League and maybe even defeatist from a British football perspective, but you look at the Premier League's domination in the last decade, and I wonder if that was more down to the fact that these other kind of sides were actually in a state of disarray. Because when they have got their stuff together and their houses are in order, they work on like a much more systematic level than a lot of English clubs still do. Because they haven't got the TV money, so they're not going for short-term quick fixes. So they build like this kind of... I mean, I know the word's got a dirty reputation in these parts because of certain managers saying it too quickly, but they've got a philosophy that they stick to and they build around it. Whereas I'm not sure, apart from maybe Man City with Pep in the years to come, I'm not sure many sides have that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I wonder as well if when in that period of the late 2000s, mid to late 2000s, when Premier League clubs were always in the semis and that was when they started to really flex their financial muscle. I wonder if that was when a lot of those clubs thought, okay, hey, listen, we're going to have to change it up here. We're going to have to be smarter. And because like you said, a lot of them were in disarray themselves. They weren't that smart. Those Premier League clubs, look at Chelsea. Chelsea are, you know, a couple of weeks away from winning the Champions League. Premier League. They were such a dysfunctional organisation, or appeared like that way from the outside. Mm. And I kind of think it's hard to argue that they weren't. The disarray between manager and players, and then you know whose side was the board on. It was very dysfunctional, but they've recovered so quickly. And have they really gone away and rejigged their whole, like you said, setup? Have they come up with a new philosophy? No, they've just bought a couple of new players, got one of the top coaches from abroad in, and boom, they're back where they need to be. So
kind of hope though that even with that success, they might try and kind of reverse engineer the other stuff now, because I think Abramovich wants his Ferguson, and I think Mourinho actually did want to do that at Chelsea, and it just didn't work because the infrastructure kind of infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I guess Conte's a man you would trust to build around, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Chelsea have made groundwork there for a few seasons now.
Obviously got Emanalo and things.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously they've got the famed all-conquering youth teams.
Yeah.
But, you know, even then, there's the pathway isn't anywhere near as close to even, you know, clubs like, even I think Real Madrid probably have had more players going from academy into first team. So there's no real imperative then, though, for them to bring through young players, or for them to install a director of football who's going to be really an authority on how the team plays. Which I don't think is really in the remit of the guys in that position at the moment.
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of why Conte was brought in, because obviously it didn't always go too well, his relationship with the director of football at Juve, but obviously Emanalo and Mourinho didn't work. But interestingly, the idea of a director of football and build that structure in kind of brings us now onto the Premier League preview and Arsenal.
Nice.
They're one club who they're often seen as like this fiefdom of Wenger by his critics. And there is a question of whether there is a kind of counterbalance to his power at the club. They're going away to West Brom this weekend. There was going to be a plane and a banner flown over the Hawthorns protesting Wenger. And he's also admitted that he'll be taking views of the fans into account this summer, whether he decides to stay or not. The plane is going to be grounded, I believe, because of bad weather. So that's not going to happen, which is pleasant to know. But is his position now untenable, do you think, Wenger?
The kind of jokers I've seen that like word used in front of a manager. It feels harsh to say that. I don't think it is, because I don't think it's unlikely that he'll stay on for a little bit. So I wouldn't say it's untenable, but from where I'm standing, it feels like it's come to a head. And I don't think that's just me. I feel like, you know, I've been to the Emirates a few times over the last few weeks, and the atmosphere is different.
Yeah.
And just speaking to fans outside the ground, the kind of, it's kind of gone from being, oh no, Wenger's going to get it right, 5 or 6 years ago, and then a couple of years ago it was, oh well, you know,
there is like a reluctant consensus, isn't there?
Yeah, and now it's very much just like, you know, I love the guy, but come on, this we see it's time to go. I think it really is this moment in time is the time that it's Arsenal ripe for something new, but. Yeah, whether it will happen, I'm not too convinced, to be honest.
Obviously, outside of work, you have certain loyalties to Charlton Athletic.
Well, yeah, I mean, so as far as like the fans protesting, so you know, again, it is a fairly small number of the fans. Again, I don't think I've ever heard Wenger rout chant inside the ground.
No.
You do when Arsenal fans go away, but for Emirates, I've never heard it.
One reason I brought Charlton up is that we've actually had a question in the pod from Fred Nathan. Who tweeted the pod to say, so, what get us to talk about basically the sorry state of affairs that are happening in Leyton Orient. And it got me thinking, because everything that's happened at Charlton over the last, well, I'd say years actually now. CNN's James Masters also tweeted last week about Orient, saying basically contrasting their situation with the reaction of Arsenal fans to getting into the top four every season. Obviously, Leighton Orient are at risk of just not being a club anymore. Yeah. It's an absolutely dreadful situation going there. Is this basically a bit like football's version of first world problems of Arsenal fans? Or is that a little bit harsh to kind of take away, even though they might be in a better position than Orient, you know, in relative terms, they're suffering, I guess you could say. Is it harsh to not allow them to have that kind of...
It's a great way of putting it, by the way. And no, I think you're right. I think it's fine for Arsenal fans to want them change, want their manager to change. And when people say, oh, Wenger's got you into the top four, how dare you be so ungrateful? You know, that's come on. It is relative. And I do think Arsenal fans are right to kind of agitate for that. But some of, you know, the flying a plane over thing, it's taking it out of all proportion. And
I mean, he's not David Moyes. Come on. This is just...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You haven't had, you know, Arsenal haven't had to endure 250 crosses into Fellaini against Fulham. But no, I do actually think it's a good point. There's, you know, actually a pretty serious point. I saw the other day that Arsenal, some of the kind of the Wenger out groups that are forming now and organising these protests were saying they were going to perhaps do a beach ball protest, throwing the beach balls onto the pitch. They've already, you know, marched on the stadium for banners. And I think that's really damaging to clubs like Leighton Orient, like Charlton, like Blackpool, like Nottingham Forest. I could keep going. Whose clubs are in genuine crisis, you know, on the brink. You know, Leighton Orient are on the brink of kind of oblivion. And when those fans are faced with that thing, they with that terrible prospect, they're going to go out on the streets and march, and they're going to do things like the beach ball protest, which we did at Charlton. They're going to have banners, and the media is going to cover that. But if football protest becomes something so trivial about a manager, no one's going to pay attention anymore. And you know, Charlton fans, when they want to kind of raise awareness of their struggles, which they've done to great effect. But if Arsenal fans are doing it because, you know, they want Wenger out, or they want...
Because they haven't signed a Cardi.
Yeah, or they, exactly, because you haven't signed a top striker for 50 plus million. It's just, it's so trivial, and people are going to roll their eyes and not pay attention and, get it in perspective. You don't need to take the streets for... you know, over a manager's contract. It's silly, and it's counterproductive to football's wider interests.
Well, speaking of protests, I'm going to make this trivial now, I'm sorry. Jake Livermore's been called up into the England squad to the protests of many on social media. No, but seriously, what do you make of it? Do you think it's deserved? He has been pretty good since he moved to West Brom.
Yeah, he's been good.
Good enough, though?
I've got a funny thing with England squads, because I think it shouldn't be... I think form is something that has to be quite long-term to merit a place in it. I think too often with England, we look at a guy, say Jake Livermore's a good example, had a good, you know, he's always been consistent at his level, but he's had an especially good 3 months, and you think, right, England squad. You can't build a squad you can't build a team over, you know, what is it, the 18th month period ahead of a major tournament, but with that method. You're going to change every 3 months, every time you have to pick a squad. If Gareth Southgate felt that he's going to be a realistic contender for the 2018 World Cup, then fair enough. And he's within his rights to think that. But I'd be very surprised if we see him in many other squads before then. So I kind of think it's a bit silly. The England squad isn't there as a kind of, you know, pat on the head, well done, here's your rewards. That's not what it should be for. It should be about building the best team.
One side that we'll be facing the very, very best this weekend are Stoke City, who host Chelsea in the Premier League. Chelsea could stretch their lead to the top to 12 points with a win if other results go their way. Do they have anything to worry about going away to Stoke? It's not really the kind of fortress it once was.
Yeah, I think this is just a 2-0 Chelsea. I think they'll be fine. I think.
Sorry, Stoke fans.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't know the Britannia's home record this season, but like you say, anecdotally, it doesn't feel like that same kind
of. Yeah, it's not so much the results; it's more pit. The intensity, the kind of opprobrium.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even then, I think this Chelsea team's pretty good at handling that as well. Anyway. But no, I think they're just.
Of course, that is exactly what Arsenal are going to be walking into at the Hawthorns against West Brom. So that'd be interesting to see how they deal with that. But just going on to what Stoke might have to offer in the FA Cup, we saw Pogba take on Kante. But Joe Allen, been the surprise, underground hit for the Potters this year from midfield. He's been playing as a playmaker, he's been playing as a ball winner, playing everywhere.
Yeah.
Could he turn the tide, maybe? You don't look convinced, Joe. You don't look convinced.
Yeah, I mean, he's been good. He's been good. I've always really liked Joe Allen. I think I've always thought, never got... He was always hard for him at Liverpool because he was just not quite good enough, right? Mm. And especially compared to some of the other players they had there. But I always felt he was kind of written off as this water carrier who could only pass it sideways.
Fergie called him the prototypical modern midfielder at the Euros.
Really?
Yeah, it was in his post-tournament report he did for UEFA. He did, like, because he was there as like a chief observer, and he picked out.
They should make a big deal out of it. That should become the next Xavi on Scholes quote.
Absolutely.
That gets plastered.
He's the
every
Welsh
meme.
Deco, isn't he, Joel? That's the idea.
Yeah, he's a good player. He's been really crucial in, I guess, kind of a lot of Stoke's games against their direct rivals. Mm. I'm not sure he's the kind of guy that's going to be able to like bring them on a par with Chelsea though.
Maybe Peter Crouch could be that man though. The one weakness in this Chelsea team is at the back on the right of the midfield. On the right of the defense. Aspilicueta, Victor Moses. They're not the biggest guys in the world. Peter Crouch, he's a very big man, 6'5", good in the air. We saw what Dele Alli did to him. He's 6'2". Peter Crouch has got 3 more inches on top of Dele Alli. Could that be a way through for the Potters?
If they can get kind of crosses into him, and if they can work themselves into those positions, then
if Allen can go full Pirlo, is what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, but he's, yeah. If that beard and those flowing locks like really kind of bring that work that spirit, and then why not?
Could be a straight shootout between Fabregas and Allen with the long balls then. We'll have to see. But moving into the northeast, Middlesbrough take on Manchester United, who in the Europa League draw. Drew Anderlecht, which is another interesting tie. Mm. Leon, United are having an old look. Leon drew Besiktas, who are probably the other kind of big sides left in it. Ajax drew Schalke, but I'd probably say Leon with all the goals and Besiktas with the threat of Ryan Babel and Quaresma down there.
You looked at those two teams as like the two that could alongside United for who are really going for the title.
And they've been so lucky because in the last round, obviously, Leon drew Roma and knocked Roma out. Yeah. So it's almost like their rivals are taking each other out.
Yeah.
But sticking to the Premier League, Jose Mourinho might have to deal with the managerial sacking bounce of Aitor Karanka's departure for Middlesbrough. We saw what happened when Leicester played Liverpool straight after Ranieri's sacking. Middlesbrough, bottom for goals, bottom for shots, bottom for chances. I've seen a lot of them, also bottom for entertainment as well, an absolutely dreadful negative side. Mm-hmm. Was there any argument at all in your mind for keeping Aitor Karanka around?
No, not really. I'm a sentimental guy. And I always find it really tough when a manager who gets a team up into the Premier League and Luke doesn't have a full chance to keep them up. But
he has spent £44 million.
But exactly, with Karanka, it's kind of it's worn a bit thin as the season's gone on. He has spent money. He spent money in a championship. In a championship, I watched a lot of championship last season, the season before, and they never set the world alight.
No,
they really didn't. And
they're just an attritional side, aren't they?
Yeah. And last season, he wasn't there at the Valley when they came to play Charlton. Mm. I guess he went on a strike. They'd had a bit of falling out of the guys above him. It always felt like there was a limit on how long he was going to stay there. There was an expiry date, and I agree. I think it's the right thing to do. The only thing I would say is there wasn't an obvious guy waiting to come in, but I think something needed to change. There needed to be something refreshed there.
Mm. Speaking of money spent, there's been a lot of questions on Twitter for Man United. Specifically about Paul Pogba following the Rostov game. Dan, obviously he's now injured, so United are going to have to play Middlesbrough without Pogba available. Without Ander Herrera, who's also missing for a red card. So they're going to have to do a bit of a rejig in the middle there. Fellaini's going to have to come in, maybe Carrick. We'll have to see what happens there. But Dan Fox has asked, what do you think of the, in quotes, unjustified media treatment of Paul Pogba?
What would you say that media treatment is?
Well, I'm going to leave that up for you to decide.
Okay.
Do you think the criticism has been fair so far?
I think some of it's been like bordered on I don't like the personal stuff. It doesn't matter if he's on Instagram. It really shouldn't. When you're judging how good he's been as midfield, does it matter that he's got blonde hair with something shaved into the side? Or no? I don't like that stuff, and I don't like people, saying, oh, he can dab but he can't, pass the ball. Yeah. It's just nasty. But I don't think he's been great personally. I think. When you're bought for such a big price tag and there's so much expectation and you know, you'd achieved a lot as well in your career before then, of course, people are going to expect a fair amount. Doesn't mean people should attack him personally. You know, perhaps they should reserve their rough the club. I'm, you know, 89 million is a lot of money to spend on a midfielder. And if you weren't convinced that if you weren't sure how to use that midfielder, if you didn't have a plan for him coming in, is it right to spend 89 million on that? If you're going to make that much, that huge, it's kind of like goes. That's what we talk about for the kind of having to get to a football and having a plan. United liked the guy. He was clearly great. He has so much talent. He still does. But United weren't sure how to use him.
They just thought we'd figure out later.
Exactly. It was thought we want him now. We're going to get him now. It doesn't. Who cares how much he is? Who cares if you know it'll work? So I do feel a bit bad for him. But you know, he's 24, and I think
just turned 24.
He's just turned 24. A lot of people say, he's still young, he's still developing. He will still develop. But Kanté was 24 last season. I think 24 is kind of a new 28, I feel. the average age of Monaco against City was 24.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure it's as, you know, he's played something like 250 plus games. I think some of it, and there's been some performances which have been subpar from the guy with that experience and that pedigree. Fans and manager and whoever could have expected a little bit more.
Fair enough. And we're just going to move on now to a kind of related point. Which it makes me think actually of when Frank Lampard was on, I think Monday Night Football, he said that for that money you want goals and assists. I was thinking that's a very Frank Lampard view of a midfielder's job. But Mourinho actually called Pogba's critics, I think he called them desperate and chasing pennies to survive or something. Fair enough, mate. But Adlerby has asked from Twitter, Pogba's brilliance, what is it? How can it be better harnessed? So, I mean, if you think it has been subpar, what do you think United need to do? What plan do they need to put in place to bring out the best in him?
Well, look, so the one thing that I've seen a lot...
You're not getting a consultancy fee from Ed Woodward to solve this problem, unfortunately.
I'm not sure it's... Well, thanks for teeing it up. I didn't know it was going to be worth one. should write a better contract next time. I see a lot of people who, you know, studied Juventus Serie A watchers say he thrived on the left-hand side of a midfield three or midfield four. You know, should United rejig their whole midfield to get that the best out of him in that way? Would it work to the same effect? Marquisio, Vidal and Pirlo, you can't just recreate that with Fellaini, whoever else. So you know what, I'm lucky I'm not charging Ed Woodward because I'm not too sure. I've watched so much and there's been so many suggestions that I've read or heard or listened, and I'm not sure how they get the best out of him. To be totally honest, I'm sorry I can't.
Don't apologise to me, Adlerby. We're very sorry. We haven't got the magic formula right here right now. We've had another question again, semi-related. It's a very popular topic because obviously £89 million makes you the centre of attention. AP the middleman has asked if United do sign another central midfielder in the summer, who should it be? But I'm just gonna say there's been rumours, not just rumours. His agent has come out and said it that if Yaya Touré leaves Manchester City this summer with his contract, Manchester United are apparently an option. You mentioned before Pirlo at Juventus.
Shout.
Could Yaya Touré be the experienced old hand who can get on the ball from deep, the regista, if you will, to kind of direct matters while Pogba runs off doing his thing with maybe a little bit less of attention on the possession?
I think that's a great idea. I think, shout. Yaya
Touré, yeah?
Is that problem solved?
It can be, yeah.
I think he's been pretty good when he's done that for City this season. You know, in fact, as well, considering how shaky and sometimes inexperienced City look, I would be surprised if they let him go, especially if they knew there's a chance.
Maybe it's a wages thing.
Yeah, well, that's true. But no, I think Yaya Touré would be good, and he's a kind of much better, much kind of well more established version than any of the guys I was going to suggest.
Go on, give me some names.
Well, I like the kid at Napoli. I wouldn't say he should be the guy to come in and replace Michael Carrick long term, because he is still, he's 19. I'm talking about Amadou Diawara.
Yeah.
But I really like him, and maybe not this summer, but I think he's one that could fill that role for quite a while. I really like Idrissa Gueye at Everton.
Yeah.
And he's someone who is unlike Diawara, who would kind of carry that risk factor that Pogba came with. I think Gueye's been pretty good at they're playing for a side that's only just below United in the league. He's been one of the outstanding performers. I think he'd be relatively risk-free. I think you could probably get him, probably maybe a bit cheaper than someone like Diawara, who's a kind of wonder kid. Mm. But you know, he's just a personal favourite.
Nice. There's also is it Jorginho? Jorginho. He's a bit of a pass master. If you're going to go down the Michael Carrick route, perhaps of a guy to sit on the ball. But then I guess again, Yaya Toure, he does that job as well. So. Yeah. Be interesting to almost see which way Mourinho takes it.
Scott Parker hasn't announced his retirement just yet, so
watch this space. Yeah. Maybe that could be the key. Another interesting tweet on Twitter. Rory Smith said that with this draw for Anderlecht, and I mean, you look at the fixture power for United coming through. I think they've got to play Chelsea in between their next ties in the quarterfinals of the Europa League.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is going to be horrendous. They've also got this Manchester derby that they haven't put a date to yet. Does Mourinho just have to go for broke now and just win the Europa League? Because that's going to be the only way that realistically they're going to get Champions League football, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, my first instinct after the draw was made and before coming on here, I was thinking, oh, well, you know, let's see who United's fixtures have got. Will that change how they approach it? But then what they're gunning for in the league is going to be getting the top four. You know, that's the same goal, really. The outcome is still the same if they win the Europa League.
Mm.
So, you know, I actually think that's probably a good shout, especially like we talked about earlier, with some of the better teams being knocked out or paired up with each other. They're kind of, it's within sight now for United. I would go for it.
Mm. Fair enough. We're going to fly through the other fixtures in order to get to Manchester City versus Liverpool, the big game this weekend, which we're going to preview towards the end of the show. But another big fixture is Tottenham versus Southampton this weekend. No Harry Kane for Spurs, but maybe no problem. Do they have the system now and the players to come and step in with guys like Son finding their feet under Pochettino's system?
Yeah, and Janssen scored from open play finally, so yeah. It's all good. It's all good. I think they will miss him. I don't think it's that simple, but yes, you're right.
It's not just goals, is it, really?
No, it's not not at all. He's I think when he first, kind of the way he kind of earned his stripes under Pochettino, and when he first started getting picked, was he would press from the front and he would close guys down, and he would link up. He linked up so well with Dele Alli when Dele Alli was pushed forward. So no one else really has that. But you're right when you mention Son. He's not an integral part, but he fits so well with what Pochettino wants to do. He's such a good, I think he's such a good guy for Tottenham to have in their squad, because he's filled in so many different places when there's been injuries. And I remember when Kane was injured early in the season, they struggled, eventually started struggling, but early on Son filled in that pretty well. I remember him being really impressive against City when they battered City 2-0. And it was a battering for a lot of that game. So I think they'll probably be able to ride it out.
Mm. Gabbiadini, obviously the other big kind of striker looming over this fixture. We talked earlier about what Leicester could have done this season with the right form.
Yeah.
If Southampton had Gabbiadini from the start of the season, what could they have become? Because all they were missing was a finisher, weren't they, really?
What are you saying about Charlie Austin?
Wow, no. He was injury prone. That's the problem. They were that's the thing, that when they had Austin, they were putting away chances. They were doing some great things, and then they lost him.
You're right. Yeah, I think this Southampton could have been previous Southamptons. They're not far off it at all.
Mm.
They haven't had the hype that Pochettino's side had, or Koeman's side kind of generated when they were going for the top four. But they've only been, like you say, a player away. He's such a good signing, Gabby. You know, he's one of those signings when you just think, wait, hold on, why was this guy not being linked with every other club like Mbappe? He was scoring so many goals.
But if we go back earlier, again, going back, talking about clubs that work to a plan, and a lot of sides apparently didn't go for Gabbiadini because there were a few question marks over him. But Southampton, they know what they're looking for. Mm. They've got the people in place. Clearly, the system's worked again for them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it does kind of, they are the living proof of having that system. I mean, when they first started to build it, they were in bottom of League One. And they've had very, very few misses, especially with kind of sizable sums.
Mm.
Really very few misses. I mean, Charlie Austin might be one of the few guys you can actually put in that category. But even then, when he's played, he's largely been good. And Les Reeds. So the Charlton connection. We missed out on one. He was our Gabbiadini.
Back in the day. Palace face Watford elsewhere in the Premier League this weekend. Big Sam just needs the points, doesn't he, really? There's not much more to say than that.
Yeah.
Sunderland take on Burnley. I mean, no disrespect to either side, but you look at that fixture on paper, especially away at the stadium, like, it's not one to dwell on, I'd argue. They're not the... Sunderland are going to just probably not going to be... the most expansive side, even against Burnley. So yeah, maybe not one to set the record for.
I don't think the Premier League is going to be pumping that one into kind of American or Chinese households.
No, possibly not. Yeah. Everton take on Hull. Lukaku, obviously, this week, after having said he's not going to sign his new contract. We're not sure whether that's just a ploy to get Mascheri to spend a bit more money in the summer or whether he actually wants to leave. But interested to see what happens there. He's surely still going to play, but interested to see what happens next for Lukaku, really.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of looked at a lot of his comments, and I always kind of get interested in how different fan bases kind of respond to these things. Mm. And if you look at like Everton Twitter, a lot of them are saying he's speaking sense.
Yeah,
a lot
yeah.
of them are like yes, Romelu, that he's on. They feel he's on their side, which I was quite struck by. You know, a lot of the time, if a footballer expresses their mind, it's just kind of hounding them off the internet. But it's interesting to see that the kind of fans are with Lukaku on this one. So yeah, I think he'll play for sure.
I kind of think Koeman is as well. Given what he said earlier in the season, he went, oh, if Lukaku wants to fulfil his destiny, he has to go to Barcelona. There's almost like a kind of a realisation that, I'm not getting backed as much as I should be as well.
Well, the other night, a lot of what he was saying was less about his contract and much more about this kind of, he really seemed to want the club to show the same level of ambition as him.
Mm. It's a bit like when Rooney said he was going to go to City as well, United.
Yeah.
But maybe with more positive outcome from the fans, maybe. Yes.
And hopefully Lukaku's career isn't going to kind of go into tailspin if he does get a new contract. I'm sure it will.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Elsewhere in the Premier League, Bournemouth take on Swansea in a battle of the kind of mid-table ball players, I guess, really. Both sides are in that space as the
Swansea would be very relieved at their mid-table now.
And I think both sides are just about keeping their heads above water, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the 1-1 draw the other week for Bournemouth, then they followed up with a win. Mm. That's kind of seen them through. They were before that, before they went to Old Trafford, struggling a little bit, I think. Mm. But they are a good side, and Eddie Howe is a good manager.
Well, I think on the evidence of this season, so is Paul Clement. Both two very exciting coaches when it comes to England's future.
That's what we should have called the Real Bayern match. That was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah. The Clement derby. Need some PSG action in there as well.
Yeah.
But moving on now to, as I said, the big fixture of the weekend, Manchester City versus Liverpool, the one you've probably listened to this podcast been waiting for, so we're going to come to it now. Klopp has a 100% record against City in the Premier League since taking over, but lost to City in the League Cup last season. Beat Guardiola in his first match against him earlier this year. It was on New Year's Eve, wasn't it? 1-0 at Anfield.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So this is the return leg. It's the league. At the Etihad. Henderson, though, is out. I believe he was responsible for 25% of Liverpool's tackles in that game against City. How much of a problem is that going to be with a side that likes to try and take control of the ball in the game, like City do? I mean, we talked earlier about Yaya Toure. With Henderson being out of the game, even with Chan's kind of more chaotic energy, could this be set up for Yaya to kind of take control of matters? With De Bruyne, with Silva as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're probably right there. I really like Emre Can, but I don't think I've ever seen him have a kind of superlative performance like Henderson did in that game.
Even against Arsenal, it was more of a 6, 7 out of 10, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, he is that kind of player, a lot of 7 out of 10s. And you kind of, it's a good way of describing it. Was it like chaotic energy? Mm. He's never going to be a Kante, you know, Emre Can. He doesn't get up and down to the same extent, but kind of in small pockets, he can be pretty niggly. Mm. But yeah, I think it could be a good one for City. It's just hard with City because I've been at times blown away by them this season. I thought they're so good. And then obviously the other night, you know, I wonder how they'll bounce back from that. They've been smashed by Everton, and then that was like triggered probably their best spell of a season.
Yeah.
So it's hard, but I do think Liverpool, even without Henderson, in general, kind of a good. The City are a good fit for Liverpool.
Mm. Well, Liverpool are top of the league table for the top six for results this season as well. Do you think that the way City play, the way Guardiola likes to push up the field, take the initiative, might play into Klopp's hands?
Yes, I mean, with the kind of guys that Liverpool have, and without Liverpool, when it suits them, Liverpool play without that kind of big, you know, big recognised number nine, don't they? Mm. And so when a team like City pushes up against them, it really suits. It means it doesn't feel like they're missing anything there, and it means that players like Mane can really come into their own. I think Arsenal was a bit, we saw that a bit against Arsenal. So, yeah, like I said, I just think City are a good fit for Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. And one player that I guess Liverpool fans are going to be looking to step up, because he's in the past, he's been a bit of a big game player. Since his injury and coming back, it hasn't quite worked for him. But Philip Coutinho, could this be the game where it kind of galvanises him, brings him all back together?
I hope so, because he's such a great player to watch. He's got a really good record against City, right?
Yeah. He is literally a big game player, isn't he?
Yeah, really? Yeah. So you know, history would suggest that he would, and in games when even other Liverpool players have kind of flattered to deceive a little bit, he's, you know, often been the guy to kind of beat a man and put a shot on the corner, or just he has that bit of he's a big game player. I don't know what's happened to him. Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's just a slow recovery injury
maybe
thing.
It's a confidence thing, maybe.
Yeah. To his credit,
he's not taking 500 shots a game again. He's maybe a little bit more trigger happy, but he's not as bad as he was.
Maybe that's what he needs.
Maybe.
Maybe that's kind of part. He was a bit too much of a highlights player, but maybe he needs to kind of
get the highlights back.
Yeah, start thinking of match for day two and not of a tactics box. Yeah.
Well, just talking about the roles of Coutinho and Firmino and Sane as well. I mean, we often think about tactical battles as these kind of dour affairs that we give the euphemism, a tactical chess battle, try and make something out of it. But this is actually a tactical battle that should be very easy to like and love. I mean, you've got two managers that have their systems, they set up their teams to play a certain way. And we've had a question through from Twitter from London Boy Les, who says, is the number 10 becoming tactically irrelevant in modern football? Consider De Bruyne, Silva, and this like kind of 3-8 system that Guardiola kind of plays. Then you also look at Coutinho off to the left rather than in the hole a lot of the times. And I mean, in some ways, Firmino drops back to play in that space where a 10 usually would. And he's had, I think, 2 goals, 2 assists in the last 3 meetings in the league against City. So, I mean, could this be a game decided by whose interpretation of this weird space in the middle of the park is going to come out first? Klopp, Guardiola, De Bruyne and Silva, Coutinho and Firmino. What do you reckon, Joe?
I mean, I don't think Les, is it Les? Yeah, I think he's right in that kind of, in one way, in that There aren't really any Juan Román Riquelmes anymore, and and especially in the Premier League, he didn't really fit in the mid 2000s. He definitely wouldn't fit now.
And Ozil hasn't always been firing at times. Well, he kind of needs a little biodome built around him of his perfect kind of environment as well.
Yeah, definitely. He's kind of right, but I kind of think as well it's kind of changed. I think you can go, I would say like Dele Alli is a kind of a modern day number 10, but he's not a guy who sits in this one space and kind of picks off passes and gets, you know, gets move started in that kind of a quarterback way. I don't think there's many guys like that anymore. I think you're right, and I think you can almost have two and people interchanging running in and out of that space. I think you see City try that a lot. You can have De Bruyne doing it at one moment, Silva the next. So I think it's more that it's changed and you know, how did you describe it? How you get the best out of that weird, you think you called it a weird little space? And it is. It's kind of
what people used to call the hole, but it's kind of been shifted into all kinds of different geometric kind of.
Well, yeah, because as well, like the hole was when teams lined up with two lines, right? And teams had two banks of four. Teams don't really line up like that anymore. So that space you kind of think of where the number 10 is dictating and spreading out wide or slotting it through the channel. You know, that's often really occupied now.
Well, you talk about Dele Alli. Obviously, Eriksen's in that similar band of space as well. And then you look at Chelsea, you've got Eden Hazard and you've got Pedro. I mean, in Germany, they call it half space, don't they? It's not the whole. It's kind of in between the flanks and the middle.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. It's kind of in that square, not in front of a D, but just to the left or the right of it, right?
It's like extending the channels out further into midfield.
Yeah. And it's probably a smaller space. It probably suits guys like Silva and Hazard, who can operate in pretty tight areas. I'm not sure who the best archetype of it is, but I just think, yeah, times change, man. It's okay.
Absolutely. But I guess in response to that, we've seen Liverpool struggle, especially against the small teams this season when there's a gap between their midfield and the defence. I've had a question through from Lufo Madabambla, who says, what position do Liverpool need to buy most? Would you say it's defensive midfield or elsewhere?
I'd say centre back.
Yeah. Bring Sacco back, maybe.
I think I saw a nice clip of him the other day, kind of rampaging through two challenges and knocking over the ref. And so that, you know, for if you want to get some social media clicks, I think he would definitely be good. But no, I just think they have some really kind of bordering on top class players in other positions. I think the guys at centre back are a level below that, and that's just a massive area where they've struggled. They concede too many goals. You just don't want to be. I'd say you don't want Clavan to be your guy coming in. You want maybe Lovren to be your guy coming in and having someone above him, or you know, maybe that's harsh on Lovren. He's been pretty good, but I just think they need a bit of added quality and leadership in that position.
And maybe if they had that, they'd have someone to step out and fill that role that maybe you don't want to waste on a DM. So it'd be interesting to see.
Because
Henderson, I've noticed Henderson having to drop back a bit too much at times, especially against a smaller team. So maybe he had someone who's confident enough to bring the ball out rather than bring a man back.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing.
Someone kind of half between, like a half Emery Chan. He's not quite, you know what I mean? He's almost that player, isn't he? But I think they might have even tried him there.
Yeah, I think it was under Rodgers.
But that
kind of brings us to our next question.
Okay, good.
We've moved on now from Liverpool, Man City. We're going to do the last few questions just before we wrap up the show. Vikash Patel has asked how many England players will get into the Germany squad on current call-ups. And I know Emery Chan was tried at right back, and with Philipp Lahm retiring from international duty, that's kind of the weak spot in Germany's team. And I'm just going to put the first name out there, Kyle Walker. I think Kyle Walker will get in the Germany team.
Where does Kimmich play?
He's not quite nailed it down yet, though.
Really?
He's touted as the successor. No, I think Kyle Walker is a...
I like Kyle Walker.
You know, yeah. Anybody else you think in the England squad that would get into the Germany team?
In the England squad to get in the Germany team?
Jake Livermore?
Yeah. Well, talking, you know, in goals, Jermaine Defoe. I mean, I think there are players. I think Dele Alli would get into the German squad.
Maybe Raheem Sterling and Leroy Sané reenacting their partnership.
Yeah,
for City.
I think Kane is, you know, like pretty much a world class striker now. Mm. I know he's not in the current squad, but I think anyone would like to have him for sure.
I guess if we're calling up players that aren't called up, again, Danny Rose as well. Sorry to be very Tottenham heavy here.
They've got good fullbacks.
I'm sure that Eric Dier was linked with a move to Bayern Munich in the summer as well.
Yeah. I'm less convinced about that.
Not sure about that one.
but I think the problem with England, right, is we have our say best 11 players probably would get into most of our squads. Our second 11 or some of the other guys we see kind of getting intermittently picked wouldn't get anywhere near them. So it's the depth that other nations have. I still think we have good players. We have, you know, five or six good players, and we've seen them playing for great teams at the top of the Premier League. It's just we just don't have a depth to match other nations.
On to more great players. Ephrem444 has asked, better fit for Barcelona, Thiago Alcantara or Marco Verratti? Kind of depends what you want him to replace, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think they are different. They're different players. I'm going to say Thiago, but kind of selfishly, because I think Verratti is such a good fit for PSG. And I really do think if PSG... you know, the PSG project, despite the calamity the other week, that is not going anywhere, and he is the kind of guy who could lead it for a lot of years to come, and he seems to really found his feet there. He seems to be, you know, always be singing Paris's praises.
Selfishly, I'd love to see him in the Premier League, though. I would love him to go to play under Conte at Chelsea.
There's two reasons that he shouldn't go to Barcelona then. but I think it depends what position, you know, are they looking to replace Busquets or do they need a new Iniesta? I think those are the two. Thiago is one of them.
Maybe the answer is both then.
Maybe.
Wowzers, that's going to cost a lot of money. Maybe they have to sell Messi first, I don't know, but that's a whole can of worms we're not going to open up right now. Final question. Nathan Hudson says, will we see a double new manager bounce this weekend as Forest take on Derby?
So it's a literal six-pointer then. I like both those guys. I really like Warburton, and I think what Rowett did at Birmingham. You know, the thing is, I'll just say, I've seen a lot of cynics say, "Oh, Gary Rowett, why is he always winning these jobs? You know, he's just his English." But what he did with Birmingham was very impressive.
Yeah.
They were in a tailspin. They looked like they were going down.
Yeah.
And he took them on to the cusp of the playoffs.
And now he's Paul Merson and Phil Thompson's favourite manager.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. It's not his fault, right, that people compare him to Marco Silva. That's not his fault.
No, he's a good manager.
And
sorry,
I think,
that bad on me for even bringing that up.
And I think Warburton's got a real challenge at Forest. They are a wretched club at the moment because of, you know, like we're saying, we talk about kind of problem owners and they're clubless kind of. I see really similarities with what's happening at Charlton, the kind of husk of a club without, that's just had its soul kind of stripped out of it, by no fault for fans. So I'm going to, I think it's a long-term project for that to want to turn around. So I'm going to, I'd say it's more, I'd lean towards Derby. Unfortunately, I used to live in Nottingham, so I've got a soft spot for Forest, but yeah.
Probably makes you picking Derby have even more weight then if you're going against your romantic instincts.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a shame for Forest fans, but good on you, Derby fans. There you go. There's one to watch out for. But Joe, that's all we've got time for, but thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Honestly, it was great. And yeah, cheers. Cheers. Yeah.
Anything you want to be sending our listeners to look at? Obviously on Twitter, Joe Hallwoods.
Yeah, on Twitter. So I write for City AM. We do a lot of like sport business coverage. So... If numbers less about footballers but about football clubs is your thing, then yeah, check us out.
Do check them out, and do check us out as well. Next week we'll be back with Nick English doing the Monday pod. I'll be back at the end of the week to look at what's happening ahead of the international break, actually, so that'll be very interesting. Join us again soon and have a great weekend.